university library, we discard worthless items every 10 years. Naturally, records frequently referred to and frequently duplicated on various worlds and in various libraries, governmental and private, remain clear enough for thousands of years so that many of the essential points of galactic history remain known, even if they took place in pre-imperial times. However, the farther back you go, the less there is preserved. I can't believe that, said Selden. I should think that new copies would be made of any record in danger of withering. How could you let knowledge disappear? Undesired knowledge is useless knowledge, said Doors. Can you imagine all the time, effort, and energy expended in a continual refurbishing of unused data? And that wastage would grow steadily more extreme with time. Surely you would have to allow for the fact that someone at some time might need the data being so carelessly disposed of. A particular item might be wanted once in 1,000 years. To save it all just in case of such a need isn't cost-effective, even in science. You spoke of the primitive equations of gravitation, and say it is primitive because its discovery is lost in the mists of antiquity. Why should that be? Didn't you mathematicians and scientists save all data, all information, back and back to the misty primeval time when those equations were discovered? Selden groaned and made no attempt to answer. He said, Well, Hammond, so much for my idea. As we look back into the past and as society grows smaller, a useful psychohistory becomes more likely. But knowledge dwindles even more rapidly than size, so psychohistory becomes less likely, and the less outweighs the more. To be sure, there is the mycogen sector, said Doors, musing. Hammond looked up quickly. So there is, and that would be the perfect place to put Selden. I should have thought of it myself. Mycogen sector, repeated Harry, looking from one to the other. What and where is mycogen sector? Harry, please, I'll tell you later. Right now, I have preparations to make. You'll leave tonight. 33. Doris had urged Selden to sleep a bit. They would be leaving halfway between lights out and lights on, under cover of night, while the rest of the university slept. She insisted he could still use a little rest. And have you sleep on the floor again? Selden asked. She shrugged. The bed will only hold one, and if we both try to crowd into it, neither of us will get much sleep. He looked at her hungrily for a moment and said, Then I'll sleep on the floor this time. No, you won't. I wasn't the one who lay in a coma in the sleet. As it happened, neither slept. Though they darkened the room, and though the perpetual hum of Trantor was only a drowsy sound in the relatively quiet confines of the university, Selden found that he had to talk. He said, I've been so much trouble to you, Doors, here at the university. I've even been keeping you from your work. Still, I'm sorry I'll have to leave you. Doors said, You won't leave me. I'm coming with you. Hammond is arranging a leave of absence for me. Selden said, dismayed, I can't ask you to do that. You're not. Hammond's asking it. I must guard you. After all, I failed in connection with Upperside and should make up for it. I told you. Please don't feel guilty about that. Still, I must admit I would feel more comfortable with you at my side. If I could only be sure I wasn't interfering with your life. Doris said softly, You're not, Harry. Please go to sleep. Selden lay silent for a while, then whispered, "Are you sure Hammond can really arrange everything, Doors?" Doors said, "He's a remarkable man. He's got influence here at the university and everywhere else, I think. If he says he can arrange for an indefinite leave for me, I'm sure he can. He is a most persuasive man." "I know," said Selden. "Sometimes I wonder what he really wants of me." "What he says," said Doors. "He's a man of strong and idealistic ideas and dreams."
"You sound as though you know him well, Doors."
"Oh, yes, I know him well."
"Intimately."
Doors made an odd noise. "I'm not sure what you're implying, Harry, but assuming the most insolent interpretation, no, I don't know him intimately. What business would that be of yours, anyway?"
"I'm sorry," said Selden. "I just didn't want inadvertently to be invading someone else's
property. That's even more insulting. I think you had better go to sleep."
"I'm sorry again, Doors, but I can't sleep. Let me at least change the subject. You haven't explained what the mycogen sector is. Why will it be good for me to go there? What's it like?"
"It's a small sector with a population of only about 2 million, if I remember correctly. The thing is that the mycogenians cling tightly to a set of traditions about early history and are supposed to have very ancient records not available to anyone else. It's just possible they would be of more use to you in your attempted examination of pre-imperial times than orthodox historians might be. All our talk about early history brought the sector to mind."
"Have you ever seen their records?"
"No, I don't know anyone who has."
"Can you be sure that the records really exist, then?"
"Actually, I can't say. The assumption among non-Mycogenians is that they're a bunch of madcaps, but that may be quite unfair. They certainly say they have records, so perhaps they do. In any case, we would be out of sight there. The Mycogenians keep strictly to themselves. And now, please do go to sleep." And somehow, Selden finally did.
34. Harry Selden and Doors Van Abbeley left the university grounds at 0300. Selden realized that Doors had to be the leader. She knew Trantor better than he did, 2 years better. She was obviously a close friend of Hammond. How close? The question kept nagging at him, and she understood his instructions. Both she and Selden were swathed in light, swirling cloaks with tight-fitting hoods. The style had been a short-lived clothing fad at the university, and among young intellectuals generally, some years back. And though right now it might provoke laughter, it had the saving grace of covering them well and of making them unrecognizable, at least at a cursory glance. Hammond had said, "There's a possibility that the event upper side was completely innocent, and that there are no agents after you, Selden. But let's be prepared for the worst." Selden had asked anxiously, "Won't you come with us?"
"I would like to," said Hammond, "but I must limit my absence from work if I am not to become a target myself. You understand?"
Selden sighed. He understood. They entered an expressway car and found a seat as far as possible from the few who had already boarded. Selden wondered why anyone should be on the expressways at 3 in the morning, and then thought that it was lucky some were, or he and Doors would be entirely too conspicuous. Selden fell to watching the endless panorama that passed in review as the equally endless line of coaches moved along the endless monorail on an endless electromagnetic field. The expressway passed row upon row of dwelling units, few of them very tall, but some, for all he knew, very deep. Still, if tens of millions of square kilometers formed an urbanized total, even 40 billion people would not require very tall structures or very closely packed ones. They did pass open areas, in most of which crops seemed to be growing, but some of which were clearly park-like. And there were numerous structures whose nature he couldn't guess. Factories, office buildings, who knew? One large featureless cylinder struck him as though it might be a water tank. After all, Trantor had to have a fresh water supply. Did they sluice rain from upperside, filter and treat it, then store it? It seemed inevitable that they should. Selden did not have very long to study the view, however. Doors muttered, "This is about where we should be getting off." She stood up, and her strong fingers gripped his arm. They were off the expressway now, standing on solid flooring, while Doors studied the directional signs. The signs were unobtrusive, and there were many of them. Selden's heart sank. Most of them were in pictographs and initials, which were undoubtedly understandable to native Trantorians, but which were alien to him. "This way," said Doors. "Which way? How do you know?" "See that? Two wings and an arrow."
"Two wings?"
Oh. He had thought of it as an upside-down W, wide and shallow, but he could see where it might be the stylized wings of a bird. "Why don't they use words?" he said sullenly.
"Because words vary from world to world. What an air jet is here could be a soar on Cinna, or a swoop on other worlds. The two wings and an arrow are a galactic symbol for an air vessel, and the symbol is understood everywhere. Don't you use them on Helicon?"
"Not much. Helicon is a fairly homogeneous world, culturally speaking, and we tend to cling to our private ways firmly, because we're overshadowed by our neighbors."
"See," said Doors, "there's where your psychohistory might come in. You could show that even with different dialects, the use of set symbols galaxy-wide is a unifying force."
"That won't help." He was following her through empty, dim alleyways, and part of his mind wondered what the crime rate might be on Trantor, and whether this was a high-crime area. "You can have a billion rules, each covering a single phenomenon, and you can derive no generalizations from that. That's what one means when one says that a system might be interpreted only by a model as complex as itself. Doors, are we heading for an air jet?" She stopped and turned to look at him with an amused frown.
"If we're following the symbols for air jets, do you suppose we're trying to reach a golf course? Are you afraid of air jets in the way so many Trantorians are?"
"No, no. We fly freely on Helicon, and I make use of air jets frequently. It's just that when Hummond took me to the university, he avoided commercial air travel because he thought we would leave too clear a trail."
"That's because they knew where you were to begin with, Harry, and were after you already. Right now, it may be that they don't know where you are, and we're using an obscure port and a private air jet."
"And who'll be doing the flying?"
"A friend of Hummond's, I presume."
"Can he be trusted, do you suppose?"
"If he's a friend of Hummond's, he surely can."
"You certainly think highly of Hummond," said Selden, with a twinge of discontent.
"With reason," said Doors, with no attempt at coyness. "He's the best."
Selden's discontent did not dwindle.
"There's the air jet," she said.
It was a small one, with oddly shaped wings. Standing beside it was a small man, dressed in the usual glaring Trantorian colors. Doors said,
"We're psycho."
The pilot said, "And I'm history." They followed him into the airjet, and Selden said, "Whose ideas were the passwords?"
"Hammond's," said Doors.
Selden snorted. "Somehow, I didn't think Hammond would have a sense of humor. He's so solemn." Doors smiled. Sunmaster. Sunmaster 14. A leader of the Mycogen sector of ancient Trantor. As is true of all the leaders of this ingrown sector, little is known of him. That he plays any role at all in history is due entirely to his interrelationship with Harry Selden in the course of the flight. Encyclopedia Galactica. 35. There were just two seats behind the compact pilot compartment, and when Selden sat down on padding that gave slowly beneath him, meshed fabric came forward to encircle his legs, waist, and chest, and a hood came down over his forehead and ears. He felt imprisoned, and when he turned to his left with difficulty, and only slightly, he could see that Doors was similarly enclosed. The pilot took his own seat and checked the controls. Then he said, "I'm Endor Levanian, at your service. You're enmeshed because there will be a considerable acceleration at liftoff. Once we're in the open and flying, you'll be released. You needn't tell me your names. It's none of my business." He turned in his seat and smiled at them out of a gnome-like face that wrinkled as his lips spread outward. "Any psychological difficulties, youngsters?" Doris said lightly, "I'm an outworlder, and I'm used to flying." "That is also true for myself," said Selden, with a bit of hauteur. "Excellent, youngsters. Of course, this isn't your ordinary airjet, and you may not have done any night flying, but I'll count on you to bear up." He was enmeshed, too, but Selden could see that his arms were entirely free. A dull hum sounded inside the jet, growing in intensity and rising in pitch. Without actually becoming unpleasant, it threatened to do so, and Selden made a gesture as though to shake his head and get the sound out of his ears, but the attempt to do so merely seemed to stiffen the hold of the head mesh. The jet then sprang, it was the only verb Selden could find to describe the event, into the air, and he found himself pushed hard against the back and bottom of his seat. Through the windshield in front of the pilot, Selden saw with a twinge of horror the flat rise of a wall, and then a round opening appear in that wall. It was similar to the hole into which the air taxi had plunged the day he and Hammond had left the Imperial sector, but though this one was large enough for the body of the jet, it certainly did not leave room for the wings. Selden's head turned as far to the right as he could manage, and did so just in time to see the wing on his side wither and collapse. The jet plunged into the opening and was seized by the electromagnetic field and hurtled along a lighted tunnel. The acceleration was constant, and there were occasional clicking noises that Selden imagined might be the passing of individual magnets. And then, in less than 10 minutes, the jet was spewed out into the atmosphere, headlong into the sudden, pervasive darkness of night. The jet decelerated as it passed beyond the electromagnetic field, and Selden felt himself flung against the mesh and plastered there for a few breathless moments. Then the pressure ceased, and the mesh disappeared altogether. "How are you, youngsters?" came the cheerful voice of the pilot. "I'm not sure," said Selden. He turned to Doors. "Are you all right?"
"Certainly," she answered. "I think Mr. Levanian was putting us through his paces to see if we were really outworlders. Is that so, Mr. Levanian?"
"Some people like excitement," said Levanian. "Do you?"
"Within limits," said Doors.
Then Selden added approvingly, as any reasonable person would admit. Selden went on, "It might have seemed less humorous to you, sir, if you had ripped the wings off the jet."
"Impossible, sir. I told you this is not your ordinary air jet. The wings are thoroughly computerized. They change their length, width, curvature, and overall shape to match the speed of the jet, the speed and direction of the wind, the temperature, and half a dozen other variables. The wings wouldn't tear off unless the jet itself was subjected to stresses that would splinter it."
There was a spatter against Selden's window. He said, "It's raining."
"It often is," said the pilot.
Selden peered out the window. On Helicon or on any other world, there would have been lights visible, the illuminated works of man. Only on Trentor would it be dark. Well, not entirely. At one point he saw the flash of a beacon light. Perhaps the higher reaches of Upperside had warning lights. As usual, Doris took note of Selden's uneasiness. Patting his hand, she said,
"I'm sure the pilot knows what he's doing, Harry."
"I'll try to be sure of it too, Doris, but I wish he'd share some of that knowledge with us," Selden said in a voice loud enough to be overheard.
"I don't mind sharing," said the pilot. "To begin with, we're heading up, and we'll be above the cloud deck in a few minutes. Then there won't be any rain, and we'll even see the stars."
He had timed the remark beautifully, for a few stars began to glitter through the feathery cloud remnants, and then all the rest sprang into brightness as the pilot flicked off the lights inside the cabin. Only the dim illumination of his own instrument panel remained to compete, and outside the window the sky sparkled brightly. Doris said,
"That's the first time in over 2 years that I've seen the stars. Aren't they marvelous? They're so bright, and there are so many of them."
The pilot said, "Trentor is nearer the center of the galaxy than most of the outer worlds." Since Helicon was in a sparse corner of the galaxy, and its starfield was dim and unimpressive, Selden found himself speechless. Doris said,
"How quiet this flight has become."
"So it is," said Selden. "What powers the jet, Mr. Levanian?"
"A microfusion motor and a thin stream of hot gas."
"I didn't know we had working microfusion air jets. They talk about it, but..."
"There are a few small ones like this. So far they exist only on Trentor and are used entirely by high government officials."
Selden said, "The fees for such travel must come high."
"Very high, sir."
"How much is Mr. Hammond being charged, then?"
"There's no charge for this flight. Mr. Hammond is a good friend of the company who owns these jets."
Selden grunted. Then he asked, "Why aren't there more of these microfusion air jets?"
"Too expensive, for one thing, sir. Those that exist fulfill all the demand."
"You could create more demand with larger jets."
"Maybe so, but the company has never managed to make microfusion engines strong enough for large air jets."
Selden thought of Hammond's complaint that technological innovation had declined to a low level. "Decadent," he murmured.
"What?"
said Doris.
"Nothing," said Selden. "I was just thinking of something Hammond once said to me."
He looked out at the stars and said, "Are we moving westward, Mr. Levanian?"
"Yes, we are. How did you know?"
"Because I thought that we would see the dawn by now if we were heading east to meet it." But dawn, pursuing the planet, finally caught up with him, and sunlight, real sunlight, brightened the cabin walls. It didn't last long, however, for the jet curved downward and into the clouds. Blue and gold vanished and were replaced by dingy gray. and both Selden and Doors emitted disappointed cries at being deprived of even a few more moments of true sunlight. When they sank beneath the clouds, Upperside was immediately below them, and its surface, at least at this spot, was a rolling mixture of wooded grottos and intervening grassland. It was the sort of thing Clausia had told Selden existed on Upperside. Again, there was little time for observation, however. An opening appeared below them, rimmed by lettering that spelled Mycogen. They plunged in. 36. They landed at a jetport that seemed deserted to Selden's wondering eyes. The pilot, having completed his task, shook hands with both Harry and Doors and took his jet up into the air with a rush, plunging it into an opening that appeared for his benefit. There seemed then nothing to do but wait. There were benches that could seat perhaps 100 people, but Selden and Doors Van Abbeley were the only two people around. The port was rectangular, surrounded by walls in which there must be many tunnels that could open to receive or deliver jets. But there were no jets present after their own had departed, and none arrived while they waited. There were no people arriving, or any indications of habitation. The very life hum of Trantor was muted. Selden felt this aloneness to be oppressive. He turned to Doors and said, "What is it that we must do here? Have you any idea?" Doris shook her head. "Hummin told me we would be met by Sunmaster 14. I don't know anything beyond that."
Sunmaster 14. What would that be?
A human being, I presume. From the name, I can't be certain whether it would be a man or a woman.
An odd name.
Oddity is in the mind of the receiver. I am sometimes taken to be a man by those who have never met me.
What fools they must be, said Selden, smiling.
Not at all. Judging from my name, they are justified. I'm told it is a popular masculine name on various worlds.
I've never encountered it before.
That's because you aren't much of a galactic traveler. The name Harry is common enough everywhere, although I once knew a woman named Harry, pronounced like your name but spelled with an E. In Mycogen, as I recall, particular names are confined to families and numbered.
But Sunmaster seems so unrestrained a name.
What's a little braggadocio? Back on Cinna, Doors is from an old local expression meaning spring gift.
Because you were born in the spring?
No, I first saw the light of day at the height of Cinna's summer. But the name struck my people as pleasant, regardless of its traditional and largely forgotten meaning.
In that case, perhaps Sunmaster. And a deep, severe voice said, "That is my name, tribesman."
Selden, startled, looked to his left. An open ground car had somehow drawn close. It was boxy and archaic, looking almost like a delivery wagon. In it, at the controls, was a tall old man who looked vigorous despite his age. With stately majesty, he got out of the ground car. He wore a long white gown with voluminous sleeves pinched in at the wrists. Beneath the gown were soft sandals from which the big toe protruded, while his head, beautifully shaped, was completely hairless. He regarded the two calmly with his deep blue eyes. He said,
"I greet you, tribesman."
Selden said with automatic politeness, "Greetings, sir." Then, honestly puzzled, he asked, "How did you get in?"
"Through the entrance, which closed behind me. You paid little heed."
"I suppose we didn't. But then we didn't know what to expect. Nor do we now."
Tribesman Chetterhumman informed the brethren that there would be members from two of the tribes arriving. He asked that you be cared for.
Then you know Humman?
We do. He has been of service to us. And because he, a worthy tribesman, has been of service to us, so must we be now to him. There are few who come to Mycogen, and few who leave. I am to make you secure, give you house room, see that you are undisturbed. You will be safe here.
Doris bent her head.
We are grateful, Sunmaster 14.
Sunmaster turned to look at her with an air of dispassionate contempt.
I am not unaware of the customs of the tribes, he said. I know that among them a woman may well speak before being spoken to. I am therefore not offended. I would ask her to have a care among others of the brethren who may be of lesser knowledge in the matter.
Oh, really?
Said Doris, who was clearly offended, even if Sunmaster was not.
In truth, agreed Sunmaster. Nor is it needful to use my numerical identifier when I alone of my cohort am with you. Sunmaster will be sufficient. Now, I will ask you to come with me so that we may leave this place, which is of too tribal a nature to comfort me.
Comfort is for all of us, said Selden, perhaps a little more loudly than was necessary. And we will not budge from this place unless we are assured that we will not be forcibly bent to your liking against our own natures. It is our custom that a woman may speak whenever she has something to say. If you have agreed to keep us secure, that security must be psychological as well as physical.
Sunmaster gazed at Selden levelly and said, You are bold, young tribesman. Your name?
I am Harry Selden of Helicon. My companion is Doris Venabili of Cinna.
Sunmaster bowed slightly as Selden pronounced his own name, did not move at the mention of Doris' name. He said, I have sworn to tribesman Humman that we will keep you safe. So I will do what I can to protect your woman companion in this. If she wishes to exercise her impudence, I will do my best to see that she is held guiltless. Yet, in one respect, you must conform.
And he pointed with infinite scorn, first to Selden's head, and then to Doris.
What do you mean? Said Selden.
Your cephalic hair.
What about it?
It must not be seen.
Do you mean we're to shave our heads like you? Certainly not.
My head is not shaven, tribesman Selden. I was depilated when I entered puberty, as are all the brethren and their women.
If we're talking about depilation, then more than ever the answer is no. Never.
Tribesmen, we ask neither shaving nor depilation. We ask only that your hair be covered when you are among us.
How?
I have brought skin caps that will mold themselves to your skulls, together with strips that will hide the superoptical patches, the eyebrows. You will wear them while with us. And of course, Tribesman Selden, you will shave daily, or oftener if that becomes necessary.
But why must we do this?
Because, to us, hair on the head is repulsive and obscene.
Surely you and all your people know that it is customary for others in all the worlds of the galaxy to retain their cephalic hair.
Surely you and all your people know that it is customary for others in all the worlds of the galaxy to retain their cephalic hair.
We know. And those among us, like myself, who must deal with tribesmen now and then, must witness this hair. We manage, but it is unfair to ask the brethren generally to suffer the sight.
Selden said, Very well then, Sunmaster.
But tell me, since you were born with cephalic hair, as all of us are, and as you all retain it visibly till puberty, why is it so necessary to remove it? Is it just a matter of custom, or is there some rationale behind it? And the old Mycogenian said proudly, By depilation, we demonstrate to the youngster that he or she has become an adult, and through depilation, adults will always remember who they are, and never forget that all others are but tribesmen. He waited for no response, and in truth, Selden could think of none, but brought out from some hidden compartment in his robe a handful of thin bits of plastic of varying color, stared keenly at the two faces before him, holding first one strip, then another, against each face.
The colors must match reasonably, he said. No one will be fooled into thinking you are not wearing a skin cap, but it must not be repulsively obvious.
Finally, Sunmaster gave a particular strip to Selden and showed him how it could be pulled out into a cap.
Please put it on, Tribesman Selden, he said. You will find the process clumsy at first, but you will grow accustomed to it.
Selden put it on, but the first two times it slipped off when he tried to pull it backward over his hair.
Begin just above your eyebrows, said Sunmaster.
His fingers seemed to twitch, as though eager to help. Selden said, suppressing a smile, Would you do it for me? And Sunmaster drew back, saying almost in agitation,
I couldn't. I would be touching your hair.
Selden managed to hook it on and followed Sunmaster's advice, in pulling it here and there until all his hair was covered. The eyebrow patches fitted on easily. Doris, who had watched carefully, put hers on without trouble. How does it come off? Asked Selden.
You have but to find an end, and it will peel off without trouble. You will find it easier both to put on and take off if you cut your hair shorter.
I'd rather struggle a bit, said Selden. Then, turning to Doris, he said in a low voice, You're still pretty, Doris, but it does tend to remove some of the character from your face.
The character is there underneath, just the same, she answered. And I dare say you'll grow accustomed to the hairless me.
In a still lower whisper, Selden said, I don't want to stay here long enough to get accustomed to this. Sunmaster, who ignored with visible haughtiness the mumblings among mere tribesmen, said,
If you will enter my ground car, I will now take you into Mycogen.
37.
Frankly, whispered Doris, I can scarcely believe I'm on Trantor.
I take it, then, you've never seen anything like this before, said Selden.
I've only been on Trantor for 2 years, and I've spent much of my time at the university, so I'm not exactly a world traveler. Still, I've been here and there, and I've heard of this and that, but I've never seen or heard of anything like this. The sameness.
Sunmaster drove along methodically and without undue haste. There were other wagon-like vehicles in the roadway, all with hairless men at the controls, their bald pates gleaming in the light. On either side there were three-story structures, unornamented, all lines meeting at right angles, everything gray in color.
Dreary, mouthed Doris. So dreary.
Egalitarian, whispered Selden. I suspect no brother can lay claim to precedence of any obvious kind over any other. There were many pedestrians on the walkways as they passed. There were no signs of any moving corridors, and no sound of any nearby expressway. Doris said,
I'm guessing the Greys are women.
It's hard to tell, said Selden. The gowns hide everything, and one hairless head is like another.
The grays are always in pairs or with a white. The whites can walk alone, and Sunmaster is a white.
You may be right. Selden raised his voice. Sunmaster, I am curious.
If you are, then ask what you wish, although I am by no means required to answer.
We seem to be passing through a residential area. There are no signs of business establishments, industrial areas.
We are a farming community entirely. Where are you from that you do not know this?
You know I am an outworlder, Selden said stiffly. I have been on Trantor for only 2 months.
Even so.
But if you are a farming community, Sunmaster, how is it that we have passed no farms either?
On lower levels, said Sunmaster briefly.
Is Mycogen on this level entirely residential, then?
And on a few others. We are what you see. Every brother and his family lives in equivalent quarters. Every cohort in its own equivalent community. All have the same ground cars, and all brothers drive their own. There are no servants, and none are at ease through the labor of others. None may glory over another.
Selden lifted his shielded eyebrows at Doris and said, But some of the people wear white, while some wear gray.
That is because some of the people are brothers, and some are sisters.
And we?
You are a tribesman and a guest. You and your...
He paused and then said,
Companion will not be bound by all aspects of Mycogenian life. Nevertheless, you will wear a white gown, and your companion will wear a gray one, and you will live in special guest quarters like our own.
Equality for all seems a pleasant ideal, but what happens as your numbers increase? Is the pie then cut into smaller pieces?
There is no increase in numbers. That would necessitate an increase in area, which the surrounding tribesmen would not allow, or a change for the worse in our way of life.
But if... began Selden. Sunmaster cut him off.
It is enough, Tribesman Selden. As I warned you, I am not compelled to answer. Our task, which we have promised our friend Tribesman Hummin, is to keep you secure as long as you do not violate our way of life. That we will do, but there it ends. Curiosity is permitted, but it wears out our patience quickly if persisted in.
Something about his tone allowed no more to be said, and Selden chafed. Hummin, for all his help, had clearly misstressed the matter. It was not security that Selden sought, at least not security alone. He needed information, too. And without that, he could not and would not stay here. 38. Selden looked with some distress at their quarters. It had a small but individual kitchen and a small but individual bathroom. There were two narrow beds, two clothes closets, a table, and two chairs. In short, there was everything that was necessary for two people who were willing to live under cramped conditions.
We had an individual kitchen and bathroom at Cinna, said Doris with an air of resignation.
Not I, said Selden. Helicon may be a small world, but I lived in a modern city. Community kitchens and bathrooms.
What a waste this is.
You might expect it in a hotel, where one is compelled to make a temporary stay. But if the whole sector is like this, imagine the enormous number and duplications of kitchens and bathrooms.
Part of the egalitarianism, I suppose, said Doris. No fighting for favored stalls or for faster service. The same for everyone.
No privacy either. Not that I mind terribly, Doris.
But you might, and I don't want to give the appearance of taking advantage. We ought to make it clear to them that we must have separate rooms, adjoining but separate. Doris said,
I'm sure it won't work. Space is at a premium, and I think they are amazed by their own generosity in giving us this much. We'll just make do, Harry. We're each old enough to manage. I'm not a blushing maiden, and you'll never convince me that you're a callow youth.
You wouldn't be here were it not for me.
What of it? It's an adventure.
All right, then. Which bed will you take? Why don't you take the one nearer the bathroom? He sat down on the other. There's something else that bothers me. As long as we're here, we're tribespeople, you and I, as is even Hummin. We're of the other tribes, not their own cohorts, and most things are none of our business. But most things are my business. That's what I've come here for. I want to know some of the things they know.
Or think they know,
said Doris with a historian's skepticism.
I understand they have legends that are supposed to date back to primordial times, but I can't believe they can be taken seriously.
We can't know that until we find out what those legends are. Are there no outside records of them?
Not that I know of. These people are terribly ingrown. They're almost psychotic in their inward clinging. That Hummin can break down their barriers somewhat and even get them to take us in is remarkable, really remarkable.
Selden brooded. There has to be an opening somewhere. Sunmaster was surprised, angry in fact, that I didn't know Mycogen was an agricultural community. That seems to be something they don't want kept a secret.
The point is, it isn't a secret. Mycogen is supposed to be from archaic words meaning yeast producer. At least, that's what I've been told. I'm not a paleolinguist. In any case, they culture all varieties of microfood. Yeast, of course, along with algae, bacteria, multicellular fungi, and so on.
That's not uncommon, said Selden. Most worlds have this microculture. We have some even on Helicon.
Not like Mycogen. It's their specialty. They use methods as archaic as the name of their section. Secret fertilizing formulas, secret environmental influences. Who knows what? All is secret.
Ingrown.
With a vengeance. What it amounts to is that they produce protein and subtle flavoring so that their microfood isn't like any other in the world. They keep the volume comparatively low, and the price is sky high. I've never tasted any, and I'm sure you haven't, but it sells in great quantities to the imperial bureaucracy and to the upper classes on other worlds. Mycogen depends on such sales for its economic health, so they want everyone to know that they are the source of this valuable food. That, at least, is no secret.
Mycogen must be rich, then.
They're not poor, but I suspect that it's not wealth thereafter. It's protection. The imperial government protects them, because without them, there wouldn't be these microfoods that add the subtlest flavors, the tangiest spices to every dish. That means that Mycogen can maintain its odd way of life and be haughty toward its neighbors, who probably find them insupportable.
Doris looked about.
They live an austere life. There's no holovision, I notice, and no book films.
I noticed one in the closet up on the shelf. Selden reached for it, stared at the label, and then said in clear disgust, A cookbook. Doris held out her hand for it and manipulated the keys. It took a while, for the arrangement was not quite orthodox, but she finally managed to light the screen and inspect the pages. She said,
There are a few recipes,
But for the most part, this seems to consist of philosophical essays on gastronomy.
She shut it off and turned it round and about.
It seems to be a single unit. I don't see how one would eject the microcard and insert another. A one-book scanner. Now that's a waste.
Maybe they think this one-book film is all anyone needs. He reached toward the end table that was between the two beds and picked up another object. This could be a speaker, except that there's no screen.
Perhaps they consider the voice sufficient.
How does it work, I wonder? Selden lifted it and looked at it from different sides. Did you ever see anything like this?
In a museum once, if this is the same thing. Mycogen seems to keep itself deliberately archaic.
I suppose they consider that another way of separating themselves from the so-called tribesmen that surround them in overwhelming numbers. Their archaism and odd customs make them indigestible, so to speak.
There's a kind of perverse logic to all that.
Selden, still playing with the device, said, "Whoops, it went on. Or something went on, but I don't hear anything." Doors frowned and picked up a small felt-lined cylinder that remained behind on the end table. She put it to her ear.
"There's a voice coming out of this," she said. "Here, try it."
She handed it to him. Selden did so and said, "Ouch! It clips on." He listened and said, "Yes, it hurt my ear. You can hear me, I take it." "Yes, this is our room." "No, I don't know its number." "Doris, have you any idea of the number?"
Doris said, "There's a number on the speaker. Maybe that will do."
"Maybe," said Selden doubtfully. Then he said into the speaker, "The number on this device is 6LT-3648A. Will that do?"
"Well, where do I find out how to use this device properly, and how to use the kitchen for that matter?"
"What do you mean it all works the usual way? That doesn't do me any good."
"See here, I'm a tribesman, an honored guest. I don't know the usual way."
"Yes, I'm sorry about my accent, and I'm glad you can recognize a tribesman when you hear one. My name is Harry Selden." There was a pause, and Selden looked up at Doris with a long-suffering expression on his face. "He has to look me up, and I suppose he'll tell me he can't find me."
"Oh, you have me? Good. In that case, can you give me the information?"
"Yes. Yes. Yes.
And how can I call someone outside Mycogen?"
"Oh, then what about contacting Sunmaster 14, for instance?"
"Well, his assistant then, his aide, whatever."
"Uh-huh. Thank you." He put the speaker down, unhooked the hearing device from his ear with a little difficulty, turned the whole thing off, and said, "They'll arrange to have someone show us anything we need to know, but he can't promise when that might be. You can't call outside Mycogen, not on this thing anyway, so we couldn't get Hummin if we needed him. And if I want Sunmaster 14, I've got to go through a tremendous rigmarole. This may be an egalitarian society, but there seem to be exceptions that I bet no one will openly admit." He looked at his watch. "In any case, Doris, I'm not going to view a cookbook, and still less am I going to view learned essays. My watch is still telling university time, so I don't know if it's officially bedtime, and at the moment I don't care. We've been awake most of the night, and I would like to sleep."
"That's all right with me.
I'm tired, too.
Thanks. And whenever a new day starts after we've caught up on our sleep, I'm going to ask for a tour of their microfood plantations. Doris looked startled.
Are you interested?
Not really. But if that's the one thing they're proud of, they should be willing to talk about it. And once I get them into a talking mood, then by exerting all my charm, I may get them to talk about their legends, too. Personally, I think that's a clever strategy.
I hope so, said Doris dubiously. But I think that the Mycogenians will not be so easily trapped.
We'll see, said Selden grimly. I mean to get those legends. 39. The next morning found Harry using the calling device again. He was angry, because for one thing, he was hungry. His attempt to reach Sunmaster 14 was deflected by someone who insisted that Sunmaster could not be disturbed. Why not? Selden had asked waspishly. Obviously, there is no need to answer that question, came back a cold voice. We were not brought here to be prisoners, said Selden with equal coldness, nor to starve. I'm sure you have a kitchen and ample supplies of food. Yes, we do, said Selden, and I do not know how to use the kitchen devices, nor do I know how to prepare the food. Do you eat it raw, fry it, boil it, roast it? I can't believe you are ignorant in such matters. Doors, who had been pacing up and down during this colloquy, reached for the device, and Selden fended her off, whispering, He'll break the connection if a woman tries to speak to him. Then, into the device, he said more firmly than ever, What you believe or don't believe doesn't matter to me in the least. You send someone here, someone who can do something about our situation, or when I reach Sunmaster 14, as I will eventually, you will pay for this. Nevertheless, it was 2 hours before someone arrived, by which time Selden was in a state of savagery, and Doris had grown rather desperate in her attempt to soothe him. The newcomer was a young man whose bald pate was slightly freckled, and who probably would have been a redhead otherwise. He was bearing several pots, and he seemed about to explain them when he suddenly looked uneasy and turned his back on Selden in alarm. Tridesman, he said, obviously agitated, your skin cap is not well adjusted. Selden, whose impatience had reached the breaking point, said, That doesn't bother me. Doris, however, said, Let me adjust it, Harry. It's just a bit too high here on the left side. Selden then growled, You can turn now, young man. What is your name? I am Grey Cloud 5, said the Mycogenian uncertainly as he turned and looked cautiously at Selden. I am a novitiate. I have brought a meal for you. He hesitated. From my own kitchen, where my woman prepared it, tribesman. He put the pots down on the table, and Selden raised one lid and sniffed the contents suspiciously. He looked up at Doris in surprise. You know, it doesn't smell bad. Doris nodded. You're right. I can smell it, too. Grey Cloud said, It's not as hot as it ought to be. It cooled off in transport. You must have crockery and cutlery in your kitchen. Doris got what was needed, and after they had eaten, largely and a bit greedily, Selden felt civilized once more. Doris, who realized that the young man would feel unhappy at being alone with a woman, and even unhappier if she spoke to him, found that, by default, it fell to her to carry the pots and dishes into the kitchen and wash them, once she deciphered the controls of the washing device. Meanwhile, Selden asked the local time and said,
somewhat abashed. "You mean it's the middle of the night?"
"Indeed, tribesman," said Greycloud. "That's why it took a while to satisfy your need."